Osho, Christianity, the deadliest poison, and Zen, the antidote to all poisons. Talks given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 3.
Our beloved Master, Yakuzan talked with Meike Osho, and later told Ungan. Meike was once a government superintendent in his past life. Ungan asked, Osho, what have you done in your past lives? Yakuzan replied, being afraid and shaky, with hundreds of uglinesses and thousands of clumsinesses, I somehow have managed to live lives. Ungan later repeated this to Dogo, who commented, it is a good story, but one question is missing. What, may I ask, inquired Ungan. Dogo said, in the manner of literary scholarly Chinese, how did you become like that? Ungan took the question to Yakuzan, using the same scholarly Chinese. Yakuzan answered, I never open any books. On another occasion, Yakuzan asked Ungan, a horse has horns. Can you see them? Ungan replied, if it has, there is no need to see. That horse is of the best quality, added Yakuzan. Ungan replied, if that is so, I'll take it.
One sannyasin has asked that his parents, particularly his mother, harasses him very much while he is meditating. He says to him that why are you wasting your time sitting here doing nothing? Whom you are bluffing by closing your eyes? It is better to read the Bible or go to the church and pray to God or do some virtuous action. This is what you call meditation. It's simply selfishness. The sannyasin has asked me, what is your answer? It is one of the most important question. It has been asked to every sannyasin by their family, friend, priest, teacher. They think meditation is selfish because you are trying to know yourself. Do some good work for others. It has many implications to be understood. First, in one's unconsciousness, one cannot do any virtuous act. Virtue comes out of deep meditation. Virtue is a flower of your realization that you are eternal, immortal, that you are divine. Sharing that divineness is virtue. There is no other virtue in existence. But all the religions, particularly Christianity, goes on emphasizing, do the virtuous act. Don't sit silently. It is selfish. I have to ask first, when you succeed as a rich man, nobody says to you, it is selfish. Everybody praises you, that is great. When you succeed as a politician and become a president or a prime minister, nobody says it is selfish. Everybody praises you. 30 million dollars are being spent in celebrating President Bush for his success. Success is not selfish. Do you see the point? Being super rich is not selfish. Creating materials for destruction of the world is not selfish. Accumulating nuclear weapons is not selfish. And what is your virtue? Is it unmotivated? Are you not being virtuous, doing service to the poor or the sick or the orphans in order to get into paradise and all its pleasures? It is simple business. Who says it is virtue? I am reminded of an ancient Chinese parable. There used to happen in the capital of China every year an annual festival. Millions of people gathered. The fair lasted for 1 month. Even the emperor used to come to inaugurate it. But in those days in China, the water wells were not protected by a wall. In darkness, one could easily fall into a water well because there was no wall as a protection. A man fell into a well. It was getting dark and his eyesight was not good. He was almost blind. He shouted for help, but millions of people, there was so much noise, who is going to hear him? A Confucian monk passed by the side of the well and he heard the noise of the man asking for help to be taken out of the well. The Confucian monk said to him, "Don't be worried. Our master Confucius has written in his book that every water well should have valves, and I am going to create a tremendous uproar in the country." The poor man said, "By the time you create the great uproar in the whole country and all the wells start having protecting walls, I will be dead. Just think of me first." He said, "Individuals don't matter. What matters is society." That is the Confucian idea. That is the idea of all socialists. Individual does not matter. China becoming communist, nobody has explored the reason why India has not become communist. It is Confucius. 25 centuries Confucius has been held in tremendous respect. So when Karl Marx became available to the Chinese, it was very fitting with the Confucian idea, the individual does not matter, what matters is the society. The Confucian monk said to the man, "Anyway, any day you are going to die. So why not now?" "I cannot waste my time. I am going to create the revolution that will brought walls to every well in the whole country. Think of your children." And the man went away. The man in the well thought, "Strange. I am dying here, and that idiot is going to create revolution." A Buddhist monk passed by. He looked in the well. The man said, "Buddha has taught compassion. You should save me. I am dying. And it is getting darker and colder." The Buddhist monk said, "Be patient. It is your past life evil act that you have fallen into the well. Millions of people are here, nobody has fallen into the well. You must have committed very evil act, murder, rape. It is better to clear the account." And Buddha has also said, "Never interfere into anybody's life. Just forgive me. I cannot interfere into your life. If I pull you out, you will fall again, because your punishment for the evil acts of the past life is not complete. So what is the point? Just die and be reborn fresh without any past evil acts hanging around you." The man was so amazed that these people are religious people, and the Buddhist monk went. It is the logical consequence of Buddha, Mahavira, Krishna, all the Indian philosophies teach it. You will not believe that one of the Jaina sects, Therapanth, whose head is Acharya Tulsi, It has 1700 monks and 3 times more nuns. It is one of the very strong souls, very rich, super rich people belong to that sect. The original man who created the sect separate from the mainstream Jainism, his basic point was that if somebody is drowning, you should not interfere. That is the logical consequence of believing in past life and evil acts and their punishment. If somebody is hungry, you should not interfere. If somebody is thirsty, you should not even tell him the way to the river. And moreover, interfering in the nature's course will create bad karmas for you. For example, you pull out a man from the well, and tomorrow he commits a murder. Do you think you are also responsible for it or not? Logically, it seems to be perfectly right. If you had not saved the man, he would not have committed the murder. You are 50-50% responsible. You saved him, he committed the murder. Now you will have to suffer for saving the man whatsoever he does from onwards, you will be responsible for his whole life. You have unnecessarily disturbed his sensing of the punishment, and you have created, on the other hand, evil acts for which you will suffer in your future life. The statement, the philosophy is logical, but absolutely against life. Is logic more important than life? And as far as I am concerned, every act brings its punishment just as a shadow. You don't have to suffer in your future life. Right now you murder. Why nature should wait that long for punishment? You put your hand in the fire. I had told Acharya Tulsi, and he has been angry with me since then, is speaking against me every kind of lie. The reason is personal, because I told him before 50,000 people that your whole philosophy is absolutely ugly and obscene. You put your hand into the fire right now, and let us see whether your hand burns now or in the future life. He had nothing to say. And his own people, those 50,000 were his own people. They laughed and they pledged. That hurt him very much. Action brings its reaction immediately. It follows without any gap. why there should be such a long gap. But the reason is, you see right now all kinds of mean people being successful. How do you explain it? All kinds of cunning people being prime ministers, becoming presidents, becoming super rich, just by sheer, it's squeezing people's blood right now. How do you explain it? The religions had been saving the wasted interest. They had to find some way. This was a good strategy. Nobody is making you poor. You are suffering from your past life's acts, evil acts. And the rich, they are enjoying their past life's good acts, virtuous acts. Do you see the cunningness of the argument? Neither you know anything about your past life, neither you know anything about your future life. Your real problem is dissolved into smoke. So thick a smoke you cannot see beyond it. The Buddhist monk moved out and he was followed by a Christian missionary. The Christian missionary was carrying a bucket and a long rope. He immediately threw the rope and the bucket into the well, pulled the man out. The man said, "You are the only religious man." He said, "In fact, I should be grateful to you, because unless you fall in the well, I cannot earn virtue. I am against the Confucian idea that every well should have a wall. Then nobody will be falling. And for whom I am carrying the bucket and the rope?" No walls are needed, otherwise whole virtue, all morality, all service will disappear from the world. Bertrand Russell has made a very important statement that if there is no poverty, there will be no religion. Whom you are going to serve? If there is no death, all churches, all religions will become absolutely useless, invalid, out of date. They are surviving because of poverty, because of death, because of disease, because of orphans. That's why they are all against birth control. Because birth control can destroy the whole poverty and all the orphans can be starved coming into the world. What will happen of poor Mother Teresa? Who will give her a Nobel Prize? Orphans are absolutely needed. Otherwise, Mother Teresa will disappear. Poverty is needed. That's why they go on continuously being against all birth control methods. It has nothing to do with God. They need the poor people because their religion teaches them, if you serve the poor, if you open the hospitals for the poor, if you open the schools for the poor, you are earning great bank balance in paradise. This is not unselfishness. Who says it is unselfish? It is more selfish than anything you can find in the world. In motivation to exploit poor people, people who have fallen in the well, people who are dying, people who are sick, people who are orphans, you are taking great advantage. All religions say you will have great pleasures in heaven. Beautiful women will be available to all the saints who have done virtuous acts. Saying, here you say celibacy, and all the paradises of all the religions, celibacy is no more applicable. Do you see the contradiction? If a man has been celibate here for 60, 70 years, he will become habitually a celibate, and then he goes into heaven and finds beautiful girls. They remain always at the age 60, since eternity. They have never grown up. They don't perspire. They don't need any deodorant. Their breath does not smell. They don't need any mouthwash. It seems they are made of plastic. No perspiration? Do you know the meaning of it? If you paint your whole body, leaving your nose to breathe, paint thickly that all the pores in your skin are completely closed, you will die within 3 hours. Just your nose is not enough. Every pore in your skin is breathing. In and out. Your whole body is a breathing system. Perspiration is a protection. You will die without perspiration. The function of the perspiration is to keep your inner temperature always the same. 100 and you are starting getting hotter inside. And the life span is very small, 12 degrees, from 98 to 110. If there is no perspiration and there is hot sun, how you are going to keep your temperature at 98 perpetually? The perspiration helps you. It distracts the heat from entering into your body. It distracts in a beautiful way. It keeps and deceives the sun. It gets the rays engaged into evaporating the perspiration. So the more heat is there, the more you will perspire. That perspiration is taking the heat into evaporating it and not letting it in. if you get in that much heat, you will burst immediately. By the time you are 105, you will fall in a coma. By the time you are 110, you will become beloved of the God. A stupid idea. And if in heaven you are going to give people beautiful girls, in the Mohammedan heaven even beautiful boys are available for homosexuals. Because they should not be deprived. And most of the saints are homosexuals. Perverted. Some provision has to be made for them in paradise. The women are called whores, and the homosexual boys, beautiful boys, they always remain young, no mustache, no beard, so the saints can exploit them for their sexuality. They are called gilmi. It's strange, here you condemn sex and you make available not only heterosexuality, you make available homosexuality. And there are rivers flowing just of pure French wine. Get drink, get drowned, swim, take a bath. And here, religions condemn all pleasures. Here you have to be a self-torturer. All religions are exploiting your tremendous greed in the name of virtue, in the name of unselfishness. As a fundamental principle, I want you to remember, an unconscious man cannot act without motivation. And motivation is selfishness. Whatever you do, I used to live in a city teaching in a university, and a beautiful marble temple was being made for years. I used to pass the road 9 years I lived in that city. The temple was just coming up, because they wanted it to make something rare. Some super rich man's father has died, and it is his memorial. I had no idea. So one day I stopped my car and went inside where hundreds of marble people were working. I asked the chief that for what this temple is being raised. A man of great intelligence, he did not took me to the statue of Krishna, which was placed in the middle of the temple. I was thinking he will take me to the statue that the temple is being created for the Krishna. But he took me behind the temple. I said, where are you taking me? He said, to the right place. There was a big marble with the writing, this temple is created by so and so in the memory of his great spiritual father. He said, for this stone, the whole temple is being created. Krishna is just an excuse. The unconscious mind cannot do anything without motivation. What I will get, and religions promise in the future life, then you will reach to the pearly gate. Saint John will be standing there with all the angels, singing Alleluia, playing on their hearts in your welcome. It seems to be worthwhile to give something in charity, to do some virtuous act. Unless an act is done without any motivation, it cannot be unselfish. I want you to understand that except meditation, there is no act which is unselfish. Because it is only meditation which is going to dissolve yourself, which is going to dissolve you into the whole. And once you are no more, whatever you do is going to be without motivation. Virtue comes out of a person who has become one with existence. Meditation is the door. Meditation is the only unselfish act. But apparently it looks people who are engaged in meditation are just thinking of themselves, not bothering about the whole humanity. Absolute nonsense. The people who are engaged in meditation are the only people who will find a place where there is no self, and all selfishness disappears. And their whole life, their whole love, their whole compassion will be unmotivated. Whatever they will do will be virtue. Because virtue can come only of a conscious mind, absolutely conscious mind. In the conscious mind, totally conscious, there is not a single shadow of self. Totally conscious mind becomes qualitatively different from your unconscious mind. Hence it has been called no mind, just to make the difference. Otherwise you will get confused. Mind is what you have. No mind is the search of the meditation. And from no mind blossom flowers of unselfishness, of love, of compassion, of sharing. I repeat Vaso, the great Zen master and one of the greatest poets of the world, sitting silently, doing nothing, the spring comes and the grass grows by itself. This sitting silently is not avoiding the life. Sitting silently is searching for the life, the very source of life. And the moment you have found the source, everything grows by itself. Just like when spring comes, the grass grows by itself. Virtue, truth, compassion, love, everything you can conceive arises out of meditation, and there is no other source for it. It does not arise by prayer, because prayers are addressed to a fictitious God who does not exist. It happened in America. A poor man, his wife is dying, and he has no money to purchase medicine or call a doctor or let her be entered into a hospital. In desperation, he thinks of one great idea. Why not write a letter to God? Just for $50, not much. And for a God who is almighty, omnipotent, everywhere present, omnipresent, omniscient, knowing everything, past, present, future. He must be knowing, my wife is dying and I need $50 right now. So he wrote a small card that, you know everything. I don't have to say it to you. You are all knowing. I need $50 for my wife is almost on the verge of death. Send me by telegram. But then he was at a loss. What is the address of God that he has completely forgotten in his anxiety and misery? When he turned the postcard, the address has to be written. He said, my God, nobody knows his address. Whom to ask? He said, when you don't know the address, the only way is send it care of the Postmaster General. So he wrote, to God the Almighty, care of Postmaster General of America. The letter reached to the Postmaster General. He read it. He said, what an innocent man, and what great trust. And because he does not know the address, he has sent it care of me. I don't know address of God myself. I don't think anybody has ever known his address. Before he went on holiday, after 6 days creating the world, he did not leave any address with Adam and Eve, that go on giving it to your children. Generation to generation, they will know where God is. Whenever needed, you can write. He simply disappears. Nothing has been heard about him since then. So the Postmaster General asked all his colleagues that, why not, we should collect $50 and send this poor man. So they collected, but they could manage to collect only $45, not 50. So he said, even 45 will be helpful right now. He immediately sent by a telegram. The poor man received the telegram and the $45. He looked up towards heaven and he said, Almighty God, next time don't send it through the postmaster general. That son of a bitch has taken his commission, $5. Send me directly. You are present everywhere. Why not hand me directly? If you don't want face to face, you can draft from my roof very easily. It is not a problem for you. You have created the whole world. You can create $50, although they will be false. But there was no reply. So again he wrote another letter, thanking God that you have sent me $50, but that son of a bitch, Postmaster General of America, has cut his commission $5 from a poor man whose wife is dying, and again it has to be sent care of Postmaster General of America. When he received this letter, he said, my God, we helped him by $45 and he is calling me son of bitch. In Surat, in India, there exists one of the richest Mohammedan cults. Aga Khan is the head priest of that cult. The cult is called Khoza. Here, just by the side of the river, on the other bank, there is Aga Khan Palace. Aga Khan is the richest man in the world. He has palaces in every great city all over the world, in all hill stations, on all beautiful beaches. And how he has become so rich? What is his strategy? The strategy is, if somebody dies, in his memory you send him the money, and the money will be sent into your account in paradise. And millions of dollars he accumulates, and the blind believers think that the money is reaching in their bank account. I was staying with a friend in Surat who is a Khoza, follower of Aga Khan. I asked him, your father has died, how much money you have sent? He said, 3 lakh rupees. I think, have you got the bank account number? He said, bank account number? I said, when you reach to paradise, how you will find which is your bank account, where the money is deposited? He said, that's right. And I said, you are a well-educated man, a doctor, and you could not think of a simple thing, and you could not see how Aga Khan goes on throwing money all around the world. From where this money comes? From which account? Aga Khan's hobby is race courses. He is the greatest bidder all over the world. Wherever there is a race course, he immediately runs to that place. This palace has been made because Pune has a race course every year, a great competition. All these houses you see belonged once to all the Maharajas of India. Because while the race course is going on, all the Maharajas were here. That's why this area is protected area. Now the Maharajas have disappeared. It is not much of a joy. Ordinary people are going to the race course. Aga Khan no more comes here. He has informed me that if I want the palace, he is ready to sell. There is another sect I have come across, which is even more stupid. At least this money reaches to Aga Khan. It does not go further. But that cult puts the money in the coffin. Your father dies, you put 10 lakh rupees into the coffin, it goes into the graveyard. Again, I was a guest in a house with a friend who was a professor and has been my colleague. I said, you also think that money will reach with your father's soul entering into heaven? He said, yes. My whole religion believes it. So many people cannot be wrong. This argument I have heard so many times, that I have made my own argument. If there are so many people agreed on something, they must be wrong. So many people cannot be right. Right belongs to very rare people. Crowds cannot have the right. They cannot have the truth. So I said, we shall do one thing. Tonight we will go and dig your father's grave. He said, what? But that is criminal. I said, I will do it. You just stand by. Just to see whether those rupees that you have put are still there or the father has taken them. He said, but if anybody comes to know, I said, you are an educated man. It is a simple experiment to expose your belief. And I am ready to take all blame. So I dragged him in the night to the graveyard of their religion, and I had to dig. That was the first time and the last time I had done any digging. And I pulled the coffin out. It was stinking of a dead body. Only bones has remained. Everything has gone rotten. And I said, look, those notes are here. And you are an idiot. And your whole religion is stupid. Take these notes. There was a moment of grave silence. I said, you take them or I will take them. He immediately took them out. And I said, now you do the remaining work. You have taken the money. I'm going. You put the coffin in, put the mud, cover it, do whatever you want. But I have proved absolutely that your whole religion is stupid and you think this is virtuous act. You are being conned by your priest. What is selfish in meditation? Just because you are sitting alone, closing your eyes, going inward to find out the very source of your existence, it is selfish. And by the time you find your authentic source of life, yourself will have disappeared like a dewdrop in the early morning sun. You will come out without a self. Just a pure presence. Out of this pure presence radiates all that is virtuous. Without meditation, there is no virtue. There cannot be any virtue. And when I say anything like this, I say with absolute authority. And I challenge every religion of the world. If they can prove that unconscious people, sleepy people, can do any act without motivation. Selfishness means motivation. You are thinking of some reward. Unselfish act means no motivation. You are not thinking of any reward. You are doing it out of your abundance. You have too much. You are a rain cloud. You have to shower. And the more you share, the more starts coming to you. It is almost like a well of water. The more you draw the water, the fresh water is coming into the well from all directions. If you become afraid that if we pull out the water, that much water is gone, it is better to keep the well closed. It has happened once. Khalil Gibran has a beautiful story. In an ancient village, there were two wells. One was in the palace, which was not available for anybody else, then the Royal Family. And the other well was in the marketplace, which was available for everybody else except the Royal Family. But one day a witch came into the town and she chanted some gibberish and threw something inside the well. People watched, but they could not understand what is happening. But by the time sun was setting, everybody has drunken water from the well except the Royal Family, and everybody was gone mad. The whole capital was mad, from the smallest child to the oldest man, except the king and the queen and the prince. And a strange thing happened. The whole crowd gathered around the palace and they started shouting that the king has gone mad. They were all mad, obviously. They all agreed on the point that the king does not seem to be the same as we are. The king immediately asked his prime minister what to do. Even our armies have gone mad. They are all dancing and they are asking, come out of the palace. We will choose a new king who is same just like us. The prime minister was very old and ancient wise man. He told to the king, the only way is run from the back door. I will keep them engaged on the front door that I am bringing the king. He is getting ready. You run to the well that they have been drinking the water. You drink the water, you, your wife, your son, you all get drunk. Unless you are mad, this crowd is going to kill you. The advice was absolutely correct. The king with his family ran from the back door, drank quickly the water of the well that the witch has made in a certain alchemical phenomenon. They did not come from the back door. They came dancing and rejoicing from the front gate, and the crowd was very happy that their king has become sane. And that night there was great festival in the capital that our king, our queen, our future king, all had become sane. The crowd is living so unconsciously, you cannot expect from this crowd any act of virtue, any act of unselfishness. It is simply not possible. It is categorically impossible. First comes meditation, then everything else follows. So when your parents or your priests tell you that you are doing a selfish act, tell them clearly that you are the only one who is going to drop the self, and there will be no selfishness left. And out of that state, virtue will follow. Not from your prayers, not from your Bible, or your Quran, or your Gita. Not from your teachings, but my own exploration. Whether there is a self, it has never been found by those who have entered deeper into themselves. The self is a shadow of unconsciousness, of darkness, of blindness. Just 2 days before, there were 21 Christian missionaries here. They have been doing a seminar for 7 years in Pune. Pune is one of the centers for creating missionaries for the whole of Asia. For 7 years they were not allowed by their principal even to come close to the ashram. That day, their course was finished. They were ready to leave to their places. They did not miss at least one chance to hear me. And they had come here. But they must have been very much puzzled, as could see on their faces. Their 7 years of seminary training was erased within 3 hours. To one sannyasin they said, that everything seems to be good, but your master is taking only the negative side of religion and condemning it. There are many beautiful things that religion has done to humanity, and he is not taking them. Now I am going to talk about all the beautiful things that religion has done to humanity. By the way, the same person quoted a beautiful sentence just on the surface. It is better to give than to receive. Ordinarily, you will agree with it. It is better to give than to receive. I don't agree with it. Why it is better to give? Because it enhances your ego. You are the giver. You are higher. Your hand is upper. Why it is good to give? You are reducing other man's dignity. You are making him a beggar. You are insulting him. You are not really giving. You are rejoicing in your ego being bigger and bigger. The more you give, the bigger ego you will have, the more respect, the more prestige, more honors. What is good in giving? It is a sin because it enhances your ego. And what is not good in receiving? In fact, the receiver has not to be obliged to you. He is unburdening you. You have to be obliged to him. That is authentic spirituality. You give and you touch the feet of the person you have given. To thank him that he received your gift and did not reject it. He was able to reject it and you would have been insulted, but he received it. I say to you that this kind of statements are all over in all the scriptures of the world, which look very good if you don't have a sharp intelligence to go deeper into them. And anyway, if it is better to give than to receive, then who is going to receive? Everybody is going to give. It is better to give, but to whom? Everybody will reject. It is better to give than to receive. Why? You are insulting me. Everybody will tell you that, do you want to insult me, humiliate me by giving me just few coins? Throw away those coins in the river and get lost. Gautam Buddha is far more right. He has made it very clear to his sannyasins and to his lay disciples, because the sannyasins will be going to beg their food one time a day from the lay disciples. He has made it clear to his lay disciples that don't feel that you are great because you are giving. Remember, the humbleness of the other person who is receiving. So first you give the food, then you touch the feet of the person who has received the food, and you give some other gift as your gratefulness. So two words are used. Giving is called bhiksha. And when somebody has received bhiksha, then you have to be grateful to him. The second word is dakshina. To show your gratefulness, you present something else. A shawl, the winter is coming, or a new set of clothes, an old set of clothes you can preserve as a memory from a man of meditation, something of his meditation must have touched those clothes. When you pass through a rose garden, you may not touch the roses, but some fragrance is caught by your clothes. If a man has been meditating, and if by chance you come across an enlightened person, to have his clothes in your house becomes holy temple. His clothes have been receiving radiation continuously of a different world, vibrations . So give him a new set of clothes, his old set is torn, too old. This will be your gratitude. So Buddha's statement will be, it is better to receive than to give. The giver is a poor man. He has nothing else than money. I was in Jaipur, one of the most beautiful cities of India. The man who was making Jaipur, Maharaja Jai Singh, it is named after his name, British government dethroned him and put his son as the king. The reason was that he was creating Jaipur, a totally new city. His idea was to have a better city than Paris. And certainly, whatever he has built before he was dethroned has a tremendous beauty. The whole city is made of one single color stone, red stone. All houses are similar. No city in India has that wide road. Wide road, and by the side of road, pavement with the same red stone, covered pavement for people to walk. Nobody needs to walk on the road. Road is for the traffic, vehicles. People have to walk on the pavement, but the pavement, you can walk in cold, you are under shadow, you can walk in summer, you can walk in rain. You don't have in Jaipur any need of a umbrella. And all soft miles and miles are just exactly the same. British government became worried that his capital will look better than New Delhi, better than London, better than Paris. It was not a crime. He was creating a beautiful city. He should have been held, but this is not the way of the world. I was lecturing in Jaipur, and the richest man of Jaipur was Sohanlal Dugar. He was so rich, he was far richer than the king. In creating Jaipur, the king has borrowed much money from Sohanlal Duga. Nobody knew how much money that man has, because he has no book. He told me, I don't have any book, so I don't pay any income tax. Nobody knows how much I have. And then I found out where his books are. He has written in his bathroom on the wall, in a language which is no more used, old Rajasthani. It is very difficult to read, and those were fast notes. You can even read, but you will not figure out what it means. Only he was the man who knew. He had come with me in his beautiful limousine to the meeting, and he heard me for the first time. After the meeting, he had come to take me, but before taking me to the car, he poured almost 10,000 rupees in my seat, and he said, "You have to accept them." I said, "But I don't need them right now. You can keep them on my behalf. Whenever I need, I will inform you, send me the money." He said, "That cannot be done, because I am a gambler. Today I have, tomorrow I may not have." He was one of the greatest gamblers you can conceive. He was known as the Silver King of India. Once he purchased all the silver available in India and raised the rate so high, and then he started selling it slowly from different places on a high rate. He accumulated millions and millions of rupees, and that was his strategy, to purchase anything wholesale from all over the country. And then automatically the rates are going 10, 20 times more. Then he will start releasing very slowly in different places, so rates don't fall. He said, "Today I have, today I may not have, so I cannot take that responsibility. You have to accept them right now." And seeing that I am not interested in accepting the money, because I don't have even pockets to keep, where to keep, just to carry 10,000 rupees in hand, I don't have anything, no pocket, no wallet, no bag, just a robe without any pockets, and I have lived without pockets, because my hands are always in other people's pockets. Why bother? There are so million pockets around. What is the need of having separate pockets? I believe in one humanity. So I told him that it will be very difficult for me tonight I am leaving and 10,000 rupees will be sitting by the side of my couch in the train, anybody will take them. I cannot just remain watching them. He said, listen. And he had tears in his eyes. And he was old man, more than 70. He said, listen, just look at my tears. I am a poor man because I don't have anything except money. I have not forgotten his statement. I have not forgotten his tears. I have nothing to say to such a man who says, I am so poor, I have nothing but money. And if you reject money, you reject me. Please, don't reject me. It will become a wound in me. Nobody has rejected me ever. I said, okay, for your sake, I take the money and I gave half the money to the organization that has arranged the meeting and has been arranging meetings for me for years. And the other half I gave to the Jaipur library to purchase more and more agnostic literature, which is neither theist nor atheist, but purely of those who are inquirers, seekers. He came with me to leave me on the railway station. He said, I am so happy that you accepted, although you gave it away, but that is not my problem. It was your money, you have given it, you have accepted, I am at ease. I have never felt so happy. You have made me so blissed out. I am grateful to you. Just one promise I want. I said, you are now getting greedy. He said, I am greedy. Otherwise, why I should collect so much money? Just one promise. I said, let me first hear it. He said, no. Do you want me to cry again? I said, no, I don't want that. Granted, your wish is granted. Just tell me what is the idea behind it. He said, just one thing. Whenever you come to Jaipur or to Calcutta, you have to inform me and you have to stay with me. Because I live sometimes in Jaipur and longer periods in Calcutta. You have to be with me. When you are coming to Jaipur, I said, I will be coming after 3 months. He said, promise that you will stay with me? I said, promise. He said, great. That means at least 3 months I am going to live. I said, that is a great idea. 3 months, no force can kill me. I have to survive 3 months at least, and then I will take another promise. And while he lived, I had to stay with him in Jaipur, and I had to stay with him in Calcutta. I had to inform him continuously that I am coming there, so you be there. And he used to run immediately from wherever he was to receive me in Calcutta or in Jaipur, and always giving me a send-off, one promise. Because he said, I am living on your promises. I cannot die if I know that after 3 months you are going to be my guest. But the way he said, I am the poorest man in the world because I don't have anything else than the money. If you reject the money, you reject me. Don't do that to an old man. The wound may be fatal. This is far more greater than this Christian statement, it is better to give than to receive. I have a friend in Jabalpur who is the richest man in that state and the biggest manufacturer in the whole world of beliefs. He used to come here, he used to come to my camp, and then he became a minister. Then he started becoming afraid of me. All politicians are afraid of me. And I am not going even to touch them. They are untouchables to me. They are unnecessarily afraid. But I can understand their fear. Anybody coming to me will lose his votes, the public, the crowd is not going to support him if they see him entering in the gateless gate. Since he became a minister, he disappears. Otherwise, he used to travel with me. Once traveling in an air-conditioned couch, he told me his heart, which was troubling him very much. He has been seeing me for years and he has never told it. People don't want to share their misery. They hide it. They cover their wounds. And by covering the wounds, they create cancer. But sometimes it happens, particularly in railway trains or in aeroplanes, people become more intimate, strange, even with strangers. You don't know the person who is. Next station he will get down and perhaps you will never see him again. And you start telling him your very secret things you have not told even your wife, not even your mistress. He told me that I have been suffering from one thing. I cannot find any solution. Perhaps you can be of some help. I said, you open your heart, just let me see the wound. Tell me, what is the problem? He says, the problem is, I was born in a poor family. Then I was adopted by a super rich family because they had no son. I was a far away relative. But seeing possibilities, they adopted me, they educated me, Now they are dead and I am the sole owner of a great empire. Because I have so much money, I have raised my old family also to be very rich. My brothers, my cousin brothers, my friends, the people I knew, I have helped them as much as possible. Whatever they wanted, they all had beautiful cars, they have all beautiful houses, they have beautiful businesses, very prosperous, because I have so much. But one thing is strange, they are all against me. Even if I am sick, nobody from them comes to see me. It hurts me very much. And I have done everything in my power to help them. And they have all turned their back. I said, it is not a difficult problem, it is very simple. Have you ever received anything from them? He said, no, I don't need. I said, that is not the problem. By giving them, you have insulted them. That you don't understand the subtle psychology. By giving them, always giving, one-way traffic, you have never allowed. Simple things, you could have asked some of your friend that you have given millions of rupees, that I was passing by the side of your house and I saw such beautiful roses, can you bring few to me? I will be so grateful. And immediately that man would have turned your friend. He can also give something to you. He can be equal. When you were sick, have you phoned somebody whom you have helped that I am feeling very sick and I am remembering you too much? You must be busy, but find out just 5 minutes to come and sit my side. One never knows whether I will survive or die. And that man would have run, leaving everything aside, and would have felt immensely friendly towards you that you remembered him, that you called him in your deepest moment of necessity. Only him and nobody else. He would have felt such gratified. But you have never done that. Just giving and giving and giving is insulting and humiliating. Your ego, your pride, this is your unconsciousness. You thought you are doing great service to your friends and family and acquaintances, but why they have turned all your enemies? If the service was so great, they have seen your eyes that you give, but you give from a very high superiority. They are all inferiors, receivers. He said, I never thought about it. I said, this is the state of the whole humanity, unconscious humanity. They never understand that receiving is far greater. It needs a far greater heart than giving. Anybody can give. for receiving, you need such a consciousness that cannot be humiliated. You need such greatness of your being that who can insult you? I disagree absolutely with this good Christian teaching. It is better to give than to receive. And I will take one by one now what they call their good principles. I have not seen a single thing by the religions which has been good to humanity. One Christian monk told to a sannyasi, that your master speaks from goodness, not from love. It is true. But he is wrong. I speak with great love for all those women, millions of women, who have been burnt alive by the Pope. With great love I speak for those women. But I cannot speak without bitterness for all these popes who have been nothing but murderers. More people have been killed by religions than by wars. Political wars are number two. More people have been killed by religious wars. Crusades. Jihad, Mohammedans killing Christians, Christians killing Mohammedans, Christians killing Jews, Hindus killing Mohammedans, Mohammedans killing Hindus, Hindus killing Buddhists. The whole history of religion is so bloody that I don't see why I should not be bitter against these criminals. Yes, I am speaking with great love for the victims. But I cannot speak with love for the murderers in the name of God. Pious murderers. Virtuous murderers. Yes, I am bitter. Because I see the crime that religions have been committing against humanity. I speak with love for humanity. But I cannot be in favor with the criminals. My situation is simple and clear. Whoever has harmed humanity, I am bitter. And who has been harmed, I am full of love for him. For all those women you call witches, and burnt them alive, I have tremendous love. For all those people you killed because they were Mohammedans, they were Jews, I have tremendous love and respect. But not for the criminals. For the criminals, I am a soul. And for the victims, I am a lotus. I am both together. In one hand, I have a sword, In another hand, I have a lotus flower. Everybody according what he deserves. So I say his statement is right, but he is wrong. Do you understand what I mean? The statement is right because I am speaking with love on the one hand, and on the other hand I am speaking with great bitterness for all those people who have been preventing human evolution towards Buddhahood. I cannot forgive them, neither I can forget them. And these people should look at Jesus. Then they will understand me more clearly. When he turned the tables of the money changers in the great temple of the Jews in Jerusalem, and he started beating them and throwing them out of the temple, was it out of love or bitterness? When he called his own mother, he was waiting outside the crowd. She has not seen him for years, because he has been traveling to the east. He has been to India, to Ladakh and Tibet. That's why in Bible 17 years are completely missing where he has been. And he lived only 33 years. So there is one instance when he was 13, and then the story jumps suddenly to 30. And he lived only 33 years. Where those 17 years have disappeared, what he was doing, and where he has been, Christianity has no answer. The mother has not seen him for years. When she heard that he is speaking in a nearby village, she judged, poor old woman. And a man in the crowd shouted to Jesus that your mother is waiting outside the crowd. She wants to come close to you and to see you. Jesus' statement has to be remembered. He said, tell that woman, he did not even use the word mother, tell that woman, there is nobody who is my mother and who is my father on this earth. My father lives in heaven. And he did not see her. And he did not call her close. Was it love? And he talks about loving your enemies, and he could not love even his own mother. And he talks about loving your neighbors, which is far more difficult than loving your enemies. Enemies are far away, who cares? But neighbors, mere talk. People think that what he preached, he practiced, that is wrong. One day, because he was very hungry and the village has turned his gang out of the village without giving them any food or even water, And they have been traveling for 3 days hungry, and then they reach to a fig tree, and you can see the insanity of the man. Not only anger, but insanity, pure insanity. He cursed the fig tree. But did not you know that the only begotten Son of God is coming towards you? Where are your fruits? And it was not the season for the fig tree. Poor fig tree, what she can do? And he is cursing a tree. And this man talks about loving your enemies and even your neighbors. Was he not cursing out of bitterness and out of madness? Was it love? I am a very straightforward man. I have people I cannot love. I know they are poisonous. I will be bitter against them. And they are very few. But they have been exploiting and distracting humanity onto wrong paths. I have all my love for those who have suffered, who have been oppressed, who have been exploited, but I cannot love the priests, I cannot love the politicians, I cannot love the exploiters and the oppressors. I am absolutely clear, and I want you also to be absolutely clear. Meditation brings such clarity that you know what is a thorn and what is a rose. Only a blind man can have a mistake. Thinking of the thorn as the rose and the rose as the thorn. When you have eyes, you know what is a thorn and it has to be avoided. And what is the rose? It has to be loved. Now the sutra. A new series starts today. Yaku-san, isness is my business. Our beloved master, Yaku-san, talked with Meikei Osho and later told Ungan. Meikei was once a government superintendent in his past life. Ungan asked Osho. Osho is a word of honor, of tremendous honor, of infinite honor. Osho, what have you been doing in your past life? If you can see other people's past life, that you say Meikei was once a government superintendent in his past life, I want to know, Ungan says, when you can see other people's past life, you must be seeing your own past life. Also, what have you done in your past life? Yaku-san replied, being afraid and shaky with hundreds of uglinesses, and thousands of clumsinesses, I somehow have managed to live life. So true. So truthful. This is what comes out of meditation. I have heard many people in India and outside India who have remembered their past life. But it's strange enough, somebody is in his past life Alexander the Great, somebody is in his past life Ivan the Terrible, somebody is in his past life Napoleon Bonaparte. It seems in his past life everybody has been some great historical figure. And it's strange to see that the Alexander the Great is a beggar today. One goes evolving from Alexander the Great, you will become a greater Alexander, you are a beggar. I have been going around the country for 20 years continuously, and I have come across at least half a dozen cases which remember their past life. Somebody has been a Krishna, somebody has been a Rama. It seems everybody in his past life has been a great historical figure, a founder of a religion. Imagination. These are all people's wish fulfillment, and people's unconscious mind are such that they can supply any idea to console you. If you are very inferior in this life, it is hurting. You are not rich, you are not beautiful, you are not a great celebrity, you are just nobody. It hurts. It starts hurting so much that the unconscious mind creates an imagination, a projection. So don't be worried. In the past life, you were Cleopatra, the greatest beautiful woman ever born. You have enjoyed it. Now let others enjoy it. Don't suffer. Just remember your past life. You have been Chinggis Khan, Timur Lane, Nadir Shah. These were the people who were never defeated in their lives. You have lived so much, now let others have little bits of victory. A football player, you should not be jealous of a football player because thousands of people think of him as a hero. You have been Alexander the Great. Don't be bothered by Sofia Lorena. She is nothing. Just a wretched woman. You have been Cleopatra. This gives great consolation. One sees that perfectly right. I have already enjoyed. Other people also need some chances. It helps you to forget your inferiority. But a man like Yaku-san will not say that. He exactly says what he has seen in all his past life, being afraid and sick with hundreds of uglinesses and thousands of clumsinesses. I somehow have managed to live life. Only a master, only a man fully awakened can see so clearly. Nothing has to be hidden. There is no need to hide. He has reached to the highest peak of consciousness, from where he can see far away thousands of lives very clearly. Not a single instance of any projection, of any imagination, of any fulfillment. Simple, sexual, actual truthfulness. Everybody is Seki. When the Christian monks went out of the door, Narendra was watching. Two or three were Westerners, others were Indians. The Westerners were very sick. Because the Indians are converted Christians. They are not converted because they feel Christianity is a better religion than Hinduism. Deep down they know Hinduism is far more superior. But it is because of poverty, need for more education, to be somebody in life, they have converted to Christianity. Narendra was puzzled. Why? All the Indians are feeling happy. They were 18. They were all happy. And they told Narendra, "Thank you, and we will be coming again and again." And the three Westerners immediately rushed to the bus and were feeling very shaky and trembling because they are not converted Christians. They are born Christians. They think Christianity is their religion. Those 18 converted ones know perfectly well they were born Hindus and Hinduism is their religion, but for economical reasons they have created this Christian personality around them. When the Pope had come to India, he had to make concessions for Indian Christians. Never such concessions had been made. Because poor Indians, just because of poverty and starvation, had become Christians. But their whole programming is Hindu. When they go inside the church, they burn incense, they bring flowers and coconuts to the poor Jesus Christ who is hanging on the cross. You don't bring flowers. It will be very embarrassing to offer a garland and coconuts. And they are breaking coconuts under the feet of Jesus Christ and bringing sweets just the way they have done to Hindu gods. First, the Pope was very much shocked that this is happening. But when he saw that most of the Christians come from the lowest strata of Hinduism, and it is difficult to change their upbringing. Somebody has become a Christian at the age of 50. Now 50 years upbringing. And he cannot conceive, why not? Coconuts. All gods love it. Why not sweet? All gods love it. You just look at a Hindu god, for example, Ganesha, who is the most cherished god all over India, for a strange reason. Just look at his belly. He goes on eating sweets and sweets. His belly has become so big, I don't think he can see his own legs. He is worshipped, and every businessman begins his books when the new year starts. The first line has to be written, Sri Ganeshaya Namah. Victory to the god Ganesha. Why? Because in the ancient scriptures, Ganesha was a very mischievous god. He enjoyed teasing people, disturbing their ceremonies, disturbing their worship. People were afraid that if he comes, everything will be topsy-turvy. The only way was start worshipping him. He was a rascal. But to bring the rascal down to the earth, to some gentlemanliness, they started worshipping him. His name has to be taken first in every ceremony, in every marriage, in every festival. Everywhere, first you have to remember him, otherwise he will disturb. Because of his rascalness, he has become the chief god of the Hindus. And he loved sweets. He should have gone into America with an inbuilt fridge rather than a belly. His belly is big enough to have a fridge inside. To take it from the inside and put it in the mouth, it goes back into the fridge. That would have been perfectly scientific. In the Second World War it happened. A man was shot into his neck. His throat was cut. Now he could not drink anything or eat anything. Because of the fear of poisoning spreading, the doctor has to cut the whole throat out. That door to the belly was closed. Now they have to make a new door. So they made a hole in his belly by the side and fixed a plastic pump so he has to put everything into the plastic pump. It goes into the belly, but the man was very frustrated. What is the point of putting ice cream into the tube? You don't have any taste. It does not matter what you are pouring into it, it don't have any taste. So finally doctor has to suggest him, first you put the ice cream in your mouth, chew it, enjoy the taste, and then vomit it into the tube. And the poor fellow has to do that. So I am not talking off the wall. Unzan letter repeated this to another master, Dogo, who commented, "It is a good story, but one question is missing. What, may I ask?" inquired Unzan. Dogo said, "In the manner of literary, scholarly Chinese, how did you become like that? If you have been in all your past life being afraid and shaky with hundreds of uglinesses and thousands of clumsinesses, how you have become a Buddha now? Where is the bridge?" That question remains to be answered. Certainly, Dogo is pointing to an immensely important fact. If this is your all, whole past, how you became a Buddha? Yakushan was a Buddha, an awakened master, but if this is only your past, then how out of this past you manage to blossom into a Buddha? This past has no potentiality. Dogo asked a very pertinent question. Unzan took the question to Yakushan. He himself had not thought about it, but Dogo pointed rightly that there is a missing link. You should have asked the question, how you have become like this? Your path is absolutely contradictory. Out of this path, a Buddha cannot be born. Ungan took the question to Yaku-san using the same scholarly Chinese. Yaku-san answered, I never open any books. He is saying that I never tell any secret. I never open any books. I have told you my miserable past, which can be told, which can be managed in language, but the secret how I became a Buddha cannot be expressed in language. It is a closed book. It is a secret. You have to find it yourself within. That is my link also. That is the link of every Buddha. Don't ask about it. It is a mystery. You just enter into yourself and you will find how one becomes a Buddha. How a lotus flower comes out of dirty mud. Dirty mud I could talk about, but about the beauty of the lotus, I am helpless. I cannot say anything about it. I cannot open the book. You will have to face the lotus yourself and see how out of dirty mud a lotus arises. The most beautiful flower in the whole world. I talked only about the dirty mud. I accept that one thing is missing and Dogo is right. But that thing you can find only by going in. The moment you find yourself becoming a lotus flower out of mud, you will know my secret too. But as far as I am concerned, I never open any books, any secrets, any mysteries. In fact, nobody can do it. But he said it in a very beautiful way. In our meditations, we are trying to find the same missing link. I call it witnessing. Hence my continuous emphasis on witnessing. That is the missing link. Once you are a witness, suddenly out of the mud, dirty mud, centuries old, suddenly burst a lotus flower with a fragrance which is almost not of this world. Something that belongs to the beyond. Yaku-san is right. Nobody can say exactly what it is. No explanation is ever complete, only experience. On another occasion, Yaku-san asked Ungan, a horse has horns. Can you see them? No horse has horns. You know it. But this is the world of Zen, where strange things happen. Yaku-san asked Unran, a horse has horns. Can you see them? Unran replied, just a masterly reply. If it has, there is no need to see. If you say, it has the horn, there is no need to say, I trust. But Yaku-san was far greater in master than Unran. He said that heart is of the best quality. Added Yaku-san, Unran replied, if that is so, I will take it. It's strange dialogue. But I would like you to know, everybody who is unconscious has harm. Heart or man, it does not matter. Your anger, your violence, your rage, your tendency to destroy, that is what is represented by harm. So when Yaku-san said, a horse has horns, he says, a horse is here, which is very violent, very furious, very terrible. Unran understood the symbol. That's why he said, if it has, there is no need to see. And in fact, nobody can see your horn, and everybody has. Only you depict horns on the head of the devil. But everybody is having horns in his violence, in his anger, in his murderous possibilities, in his destructiveness. Yaku-san said that heart is of the best quality. In fact, if you have a heart which is really wild, furious, violent, it is a great heart in war. It will trample thousands of people. You have just to rush over the army of the enemy. In the past, horse was the only nuclear weapon. Yaku-san said that horse is of the best quality. Unran replied, if that is so, I will take it. This whole dialogue is not what it appears apparently. It is a dialogue about your unconsciousness, out of which all that is violent, all that is destructive, all that is ugly arises. Your unconscious has harm. In other words, your unconscious is the only devil. There is no other devil anywhere else. But when Yaku-san said that heart is of the best quality, your unconsciousness has two possibilities. If it remains unconscious, it is destructive, dangerous to you and to others. But if you bring life to it, if it turns into consciousness, that is its another possibility. Then it has the best quality in the world. You become a Buddha. That's why Ungan said, if that is so, that it is of the best quality, I will take it. I am ready to become a Buddha. It would have been difficult for you to enter into this dialogue. You would have thought it seems to be absurd. It is not. These people are meditative people who have been meditating for years. They understand the symbols, they understand the deeper psychology, the parapsychology and the beyond of psychology. So their dialogues are not ordinary dialogues. Even the dialogues of Socrates are ordinary. Ordinary not in the sense that you will be able to understand them. Ordinary in the sense that they are only logical dialogues, very refined logic, very sharp and very complicated, but after all, it is the function of the mind. Socrates could not reach to the function of no mind. He was unaware of the Eastern self. There were other contemporaries of Socrates who had reached the East, Pythagoras. And Pythagoras became a Buddha. Socrates had every possibility, but he remained confined in the mind. He went on sharpening the sword of logic. He cuts very fine arguments. He is very convincing. But as far as awakening is concerned, he is as fast asleep as anyone else. His contemporary Pythagoras moved from Athens to Alexandria and from Alexandria to India. It was the time when Buddha was alive, when Mahavira was alive, when six other great thinkers of the same quality as Gautam Buddha were alive, all in the small state of Bihar. And Pythagoras traveled to Bihar, met all great enlightened people. He was young, but he reached to India in the right time. Just as you have reached to India in the right time. Ikon wrote, "Who shall halt the swan in its flight? Our life in its flow." I have been telling you, everything is moving so fast, and there is nobody who is capable to prevent a swan in the flight . The great swans live in the Himalayas, deep in the highest lake in the world, Mansarovar. Mansarovar remains frozen for 9 months. You can drive a car on it. It is miles and miles long lake. But the snow becomes hard stone. Swans come, they have to come because no water to drink, no fish to eat. The thick layers of hard snow, they cannot manage. 3,000 miles they fly over the Himalayas and come to North India around a small lake, river. It is a very mysterious phenomenon. In those 3 months, nature has such balance, such harmony, that those 3 months are the months for their mating also. So they mate and they lay the egg. But before the egg opens and their children come out, 3 months are over. I mean, 9 months are over. Now the Mansarovar will be melted. They fly again, leaving the egg in the plains of North India. 3,000 miles flight, thousands and thousands of swans disappearing into the Himalayas. The miracle is, parents are gone, then the eggs open, and those small swans immediately start moving towards Mansarovar. They don't have any nest, no guide, no parents to tell them which route to take, but exactly the same route as the parents had taken for millions of years. Every year the miracle happens. Those small swans start flying 3,000 miles high above the Himalayan peak, where the snow has never melted since eternity. And they take the same route and they reach to the same Mansarovar lake. And people think nature has no intelligence. Nature has tremendous wisdom. Just we have forgotten to listen to it. The only way for you to listen to nature is going deeper into yourself, because there are roots which are spread into existence. Those roots still understand the language of existence. Far away from the roots, you are hung up in the head. You don't know anything about the wisdom of existence. That's why you ask questions which are not needed at all. You need only one thing: to find a connecting link with existence, and all questions disappear. My new symbol is going to be a flying swan. Who shall halt the swan in its flight, or life in its flow? But people try hard. Just look at the wind. They halt again and again. Although life goes on, it does not listen. A 16-year-old woman will take almost 3 years to become 70. And as the age grows, the gap becomes bigger. Never ask a woman her age. Always tell a woman, you look very younger. Even if the woman has 1 foot in the grave and another foot in the church, still you have to say, you look so young, so fresh, so radiant. And even an old dying woman will have a rush on her face of youth. Sometimes I think perhaps even a dead woman if persuaded rightly will start having a rush. Her cheeks will become red. Yes, I think I have not tried. But there is every possibility of it being true. At the age of 36, that is the finding of the psychologist, women stop. Because now this is very dangerous to go beyond 36. It will take almost 4 years to become 37. Now, things are dangerous ahead. A woman becomes with very difficulty, very reluctant, 40. Because the dangerous time is coming. When people will start telling her, you look very younger. Nobody says that to young women. There is no point. A young woman is young. Whenever somebody tells you, you are looking very young, take it for granted. Avirbhava. That you have gone beyond. People are being very nice to you. People try, but nobody succeeds. One has to become old. And when you are reluctantly becoming old, old age becomes ugly. When you are joyously becoming old, old age has a beauty of its own, a grandeur of its own, a ripeness, a maturity, a centering. Young people have nothing compared to the experience who have lived the life and who know it is all just a game. The moment one person comes to the point that whole life is just a game, his old age is so beautiful, it's so graceful. No young person can be compared to it. His white hair will look like white snow. Just on the highest peak of the mountain, he will die with joy. He has lived his life. Now he is entering into a new phase, death. He will not be reluctant. If he was not reluctant for old age, he will not be reluctant for death. If he accepted old age joyously, he will accept death also dancingly. He will go with death dancingly. And if a man can go joyously with death, there is no death for him. He enters into eternal life. Then there is no birth, no death. He has gone beyond the circle of birth and death. Manisha's question, our beloved Master, are there certain conditionings such as guilt, fear, jealousy that are not peculiar to Christianity alone but have been endorsed by all religions in all cultures since time immemorial? Manisha, No religion can exist without guilt. It is an absolute necessity for a religion that people should feel guilty. No religion can exist without creating fear in people. Fear of hell, fear of punishment, fear of eternal fire. No religion can gather masses and exploit them without guilt and fear. A guilty person feels somehow to find a savior. He has committed sin. And all religions create as many sins as possible. In fact, everything that makes you happy is a sin. Everything that makes you a long face Englishman is virtue. Guilt is needed absolutely, but how to create guilt? First, you have to indicate people that all these things are sin. If you commit these things, you will be guilty. And you will suffer immensely for it. Eternal hellfire. So guilt creates fear that, my God, I have loved a woman. And all the religions say the woman is the gate for hell. I have been always wondering, if the woman is the gate for hell, then no woman can go into hell. She is the gate. Gates don't move. Gates don't walk. Only man can go into hell. The woman remains outside hell. She may not enter into heaven, but outside hell. I think this is perfectly good position. Allow as many men to go into hell. Hell, poor teachers. And you need not be afraid, you are the gate. Don't love a woman, otherwise you are finished. Don't dance, and don't sing, and don't look happy. Look miserable. The more miserable you look, the more religious you are. And miserable people are created by the same strategy, because they cannot commit sin and they have every desire to commit. So everything is propelling them to commit the sin, and they cannot commit because the hell is there. This creates such a dilemma that half of them is ready to commit and half of them is escaping. So they are stuck. They cannot move towards sin, they cannot move towards paradise. In this stuck state, they feel utterly miserable. These miserable people gather into churches, into temples, into mass for the priest to guide them, help them. If they have committed some sin that makes them guilty and miserable, that I have committed. Religion, relish and get nourished on your guilt, on your sins. Christianity has made them more emphatically clear than other religions, but other religions also have the same strategy. Jealousy is created by the religion's continuous emphasis for monogamy, and monogamy means not in the dictionary but in life monotony. And nobody wants to live in a monotonous life. Marriage is a great strategy. Married couples are the most miserable people in the world. And religions insist no divorce. Divorce is a sin. So prostitutes are created. This is the byproduct of religion. These are the good things that religion has done. First create monotony, that is marriage. Then prostitutes are bound to come because man is a polygamous animal. You cannot change his nature. It is an inbuilt process. So is woman. But it does not look so apparently. The reason is the woman has been deprived of education, of economic freedom, of movement into society. So rather than being polygamous, her security is in remaining monogamous, although she suffers as much as the man, perhaps more, because man has created prostitutes. You will be surprised that in India, there were pious prostitutes called Devadasi. They are still in the South India. Beautiful girls. Parents will dedicate those girls to the temple. They become servants of God. Actually, they are prostitutes for the priest, first. Second, they are prostitutes for the rich people who can pay to the priest. And every great temple have hundreds of Devadasis, even today. In the name of religion. And why parents, knowing perfectly well, go on giving their beautiful girls? Only beautiful girls are chosen by the priest, by the saint. Because in India, particularly, to have a daughter is to have a catastrophe. Because to get her married, you may have to sell your house, your business, your land, everything. You have to give so much money because the parents of the boy whom you are marrying your daughter ask for money. He has brought up the boy 25 years, then he became a professor. For 25 years you have to pay money, because now he will not be any more of the parents, he will belong to the wife. There is some logic in it. So even though the constitution prohibits it, it continues in indirect ways. A car is needed, a house is needed, where they will live. And if you cannot give, then keep your daughter. And Indians are very much afraid if the daughter goes on becoming older, less chances for marriage. Because every man wants a woman in every way inferior. She should be in height smaller than the man. She should not be so educated as the man. She should not be as strong as the man. This is the masochist, male chauvinist society. So man has found prostitutes just once in a while to get out of the monotony. Religions create great things. Marriage, prostitutes, devadasis. Now, women's liberation movement has started creating male prostitutes in Europe, particularly in London. Now in London you can find male prostitutes. This is a new phenomenon. Now women can also have a holiday from the husband. And if you cannot go to the prostitutes because it is so disrespectful, red light district, you cannot even pass. You may not be going to the prostitutes, you may be just passing the street, but you cannot enter if somebody sees. So there are freelance prostitutes without any license. They are called call girls. You don't have to go. In every hotel, in every room, there is a Bible. Open the Bible. On the first page you will find, look on the 90th page. You open the 90th page and you find the address and phone number of glorious Gloria. Just give a call and she will come to your room number directly. No question of being disrespected, dishonorable. So judges, politicians, super rich, They stay in 5-star hotels, and every Bible has the address. Just give a call. Perhaps in London now they will be having for male prostitutes also the address. Call boys. These are all the great things that religion has done. And because of marriage, jealousy arises. These are all linked with one another. When you feel unhappy with your wife, you start looking around in the neighborhood. And the wife is constantly watching where your eyes are moving. Why you are always sitting by the side of the fence. Reading newspaper. And that newspaper is just to hide the wife so she cannot see your face where you are looking. Making signs, smiling. Newspaper is a great help. And wives are very angry. They snatch the newspaper immediately. I was wondering why wives are against newspapers. But by and by I found out the reason. Now jealousy arises. The other man is also frustrated. His wife is also frustrated. You are also frustrated. Your wife is also frustrated. All these frustrated people created by religion. And then they are jealous. The wife is afraid. She has children. Uneducated. No financial position. The whole finance is in the hands of the husband. He is just a commodity. Because you have reduced the woman into a commodity, she is constantly watching where you are going, what you are doing. She is looking into your pockets. She is even watching when you are sleeping. I have heard a woman was watching the husband while he was sleeping. Not in his sleep, he cannot go anywhere, but in his sleep he was talking to some woman, Maria. Sweetheart, sugar pie. The woman immediately shook the husband that who is this Maria? Husbands have also become clever. He says, Maria? It is a heart. And I am thinking to take part in the coming race course, and Maria seems to be the right heart. The wife said, okay. In the morning, Maria phoned. The wife takes immediately the phone. She never allows the husband to take the phone. She told the husband that the horse is calling. Unless marriage disappears from the world, jealousy cannot disappear. But religion is very insistent on marriage. He is not worried about the suffering of millions of people unnecessarily. People are driving each other mad with their jealousy, with their new girlfriends, and men are also jealous. It is not that only women are jealous. Men are jealous because they want their wife to be absolutely dedicated to them. They know they are not dedicated, but they are men. Boys are boys. All this dedication and surrender is for the woman. Boys are boys and will remain always boys. But I say to you, girls are girls. It is time for Gurdwara Singh. Harry Manners is very proper British gentleman. Is in the habit of taking his wife, Mabel, on holiday to France every year. This year, they are staying as usual in their little seaside cottage. When Mabel becomes suddenly ill and dies, Harry is very upset, but manages to keep the British stiff upper lip and decides to have Mabel's funeral there in the French village. Monsieur Felix, the mayor, lends Harry a black suit for the funeral, but being British, Harry feels it would not be proper to go without a black hat. He feels that his wife, Mabel, would expect it of him. So Harry goes into town to the local men's shop and tries in his best French to ask the salesman for a black hat. Have you a capot noir? Ask Harry. The salesman thinks Harry is mad because in French capot means condom. So he points to the pharmacy across the road and sends Harry there. Have you a capot noir? Asked Harry, wondering why the French keep black heads in a pharmacy. Monsieur, replies Madame Fifi from behind the counter, we have pink ones, blue ones, green ones, and ones with feathers, but no black ones. That is too bad, thinks Harry to himself, wondering how he is going to get a black hat. But Masood ask Madam Fifi, may I ask you, why do you want a black one? Vivi, replies Harry, hopefully it is for my wife. You see, she is dead. Ah, yes. Madam Fifi, with admiration, you British, so cultured. Jack and Jill, two jerks, are sitting in their living room one evening talking about the future of their young son Jack. Jack, says Jill, I wonder what little Jack will grow up to be. I know how we can find out, says Jack. Watch this. And Jack pulls a $10 bill out of his pocket, setting it on the table. If he takes this money, says Jack, smiling, then he will grow up to be a banker. Then Jack takes a dusty old Bible off the bookshelf and sets it on the table next to the money. Now, says Jack excitedly, if he takes the Bible, for sure he will grow up to be a great TV evangelist like Jimmy Becker. Next, Jack pulls out a bottle of whiskey from the cabinet and sets it on the table alongside the other items and says Jack seriously, if he goes for this whiskey bottle, then he will be just turned out to be a bum. Quietly, Jack and Jill jerk, go and hide in the next room. When they hear little George coming in, George is whistling happily when he suddenly sees all the articles sitting on the table. He looks around to make sure that he is alone, and then he walks over and picks up the $10 bill. He holds it up to the light and fingers it gently. Then he puts it down and picks up the Bible. He blows the dust off and thumbs through a few pages and puts it back down. Little George looks around again, then he quickly uncorks the whiskey bottle and sniffs the contents. Suddenly, in one motion, he stuffs the money in his pocket, sticks the Bible under his arm, grabs the whiskey bottle by the neck and walks out of the room whistling. My goodness, says Mrs. Jerk, what does that mean? He will grow up to be. Ah, cries her husband, it means he is going to be a politician. Justice Dunn is the presiding judge in a case where Paddy is called as a witness. The judge is asking Paddy some questions. Did you see the defense witness fall over in the street? Asked Judge Dunn. Who? Me? Asked Paddy. Yes, you, replies the judge. No, not me, says Paddy. Did you see the witness at all? Asked Justice Dunn. Who? Me? Asked Paddy. Yes, you, replies the judge. No, not me, says Paddy. Then why are you here? Asked the judge. Who? Me? Asked Paddy. Yes, you, replies the judge. To see justice done, says Paddy. Who? Me? Ask justice done. be silent. Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment you can enter in. Look inward. Gather all your life energy and your total consciousness, and with an urgency, as if this is going to be your last moment on the earth. Faster and faster, deeper and deeper, as you come closer to your center, a great silence surrounds you, and flowers of blissfulness start flowering like rain. The moment you reach to the center, you have found your original face. The East has called the original face the Buddha, the awakened one. The Buddha has only one quality, witnessing. Witness that you are not the body. Witness that you are not the mind. Witness that you are not the seven subtle bodies behind the body, layer upon layer. Witness that you are only a witness and nothing else. It's your consciousness. And suddenly, out of the dirty mud, the lotus starts growing. A sunrise. And the lotus opens its petals. And on its petals, you can see beautiful dewdrops shining in the morning sun with such glory, with such splendor, that even pearls will feel jealous. At this moment, you are the most blessed people on the earth. The whole world is looking for mundane things, for very ordinary, mediocre, outward commodities, money, power, prestige. All these will be left when you die. Only witnessing will go with you. Just like wings, your consciousness will fly into eternity. You will be a swan going to the home, disappearing into the blue sky, into the ultimate cosmos. We have called the awakened ones another name also, Paramhansa, the great swan. Who flies alone into the unknown and disappear into the cosmos, becomes one with the cosmos, not a part but the whole. To make it more clear, Nivedana, relax, but go on witnessing. Go on remaining the Buddha. Such great ecstasy, such deep divine drunkenness, and your consciousness is melting. The Gautam Buddha auditorium is turning into an ocean of consciousness without any ripples. Collect as many flowers of the beyond, as many fragrances of the lotus that is growing at the center of your being. And on the lotus the Buddha is sitting. Persuade the Buddha to come along with you. He is your very nature. This is the first step into religiousness. To bring the Buddha so closer that you disappear and only Buddha remains. Then the second step is very easy. No guidance is needed. You can take the quantum leap from Buddha into the cosmos, either now or at the time of your death. But bring him closer and closer, inch by inch, every day he's coming closer. Soon you will find him just like a shadow, always following you. First, second, you will become the shadow following him. I'm so tremendously happy seeing your sincerity, seeing your earnestness, seeing your total inquiry into your own nature. This is the ultimate sign. Nivedana, come back, but come back as a Buddha, with all the flowers and the fragrances, with all the grace and the beauty too, with all the poetry and all the songs. Just sit down for a few moments to recollect where you have been, what path you have followed, what has been happening at the center of your being. The center of your being is the very door into existence. Not only Yakushan calls that isness is my business, I also say to you, isness is also my business. Isness simply means to be here and now. To be here and now, and you are the Buddha. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, we have a thought.
Thank you.